www.parstoday.com/en.
The Taliban capture Talagan city in northeast Afghanistan, bringing to three the number of provincial capitals seized in one day. U.S. rescue teams are working around the clock to find eight people who went missing following a historic wildfire ripping through Northern California. India reports over 39,000 new cases of the coronavirus, taking its tally to nearly 32 million. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to this fast-moving story in Afghanistan, where the Taliban have captured yet another Afghan provincial capital as government forces try to halt the militant group's sweeping advances across the country. Now, according to a security source, the militants have just seized the city of Talagan, the capital of Takhar province. That's the fifth provincial capital that the Taliban have seized in 2 days. Earlier on Sunday, they took over the cities of Saripol and Kunduz. Afghan officials say heavy fighting is continuing in Kunduz. Before that, the Taliban took Zaranj and Shabargan, both provincial capitals. The latest losses are seen as a major blow to the Afghan government that has pledged to push back the militants. The Taliban have already seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks. We're going to cross over to Kabul to get the latest on this story, joined by Amin Alami. Definitely moving fast. Tell us about the overall situation on the ground there.
Well, Marcia, despite suffering heavy casualties, the Taliban militants have, over the past 2 days, captured some major cities in northern and western Afghanistan. Shabargan, the capital city of Juzjan province, as well as Saripol and Kunduz, the capital cities of Saripol and Kunduz provinces in northern Afghanistan, were already captured by the Taliban militants. But just a few hours ago, the militant group took control over Talaqan, the capital city of northeastern Takhar province of Afghanistan. That paves the way for the militant group to easily get into Badakhshan, another northeastern province that connects Afghanistan to Tajikistan, China, and Pakistan. In the meantime, Afghan military forces on the ground there in Takhar province say that they are resisting in some parts of the city against the expanding attacks of hundreds of Taliban militants who have increased their attacks mainly on government buildings that most of those buildings have already been captured by the Taliban militants. In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says that the entire city of Talaqan, the capital of Takhar province, is currently under the control of the militants, and there is no resisting against these forces inside the city, either by Afghan national security forces or local armed fronts. But as facts on the ground show, and some members of Takhar Provincial Council and some members of local armed fronts in this part of Afghanistan say, there are some fightings are underway between Afghan security forces and Taliban across some parts of the city of Talaqan. And they say that still Afghan security forces are there resisting against the Taliban militants. However, military commanders in southern Afghanistan say that They have pushed back Taliban militants from some key sites of Lashkargah, the capital city of Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. According to the commander of 2015 Corps of the Afghan National Army in Helmand, the Afghan military forces, mainly Afghan Air Force and the elite commando forces of Afghan National Army, have killed over 400 Taliban militants over the past 24 hours. In the meantime, Afghanistan's defense ministry here in Kabul confirms that the Taliban have lost at least 800 of its members over the past 5 days as a recent clash, as a result of recent clash between the Taliban and Afghan security forces. But Mosia, let's not forget that either Tahar or Juzjan and Kunduz provinces in northern Afghanistan, or Helmand and Nimruz provinces located in southern Afghanistan, Tahar in northern Afghanistan, Juzjan in northern Afghanistan, and Kunduz in northern Afghanistan. Despite this, an ongoing clash have prompted thousands of Afghan locals in Ghazni city, the capital of Ghazni province, to leave their houses in search of shelter. According to local sources in Ghazni in southern Afghanistan, the city is currently under the besiege of the Taliban militants, and it has completely been besieged by Taliban militants, and Afghan security forces are present just inside the buildings of governmental installations inside this city that is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway. However, Afghan military officials in eastern Afghanistan say that despite the expanding attacks of Taliban all over Afghanistan, mainly on big cities, Afghan military forces have recaptured some areas in this part of Afghanistan, particularly in Nangarhar, Kapisa, and Parwan provinces. The governor of Parwan province confirmed that Afghan military forces backed by local armed fronts have pushed back a Taliban attack from on Sheikh Ali district located in northern Parwan province that connects this northern province to strategic central province of Bamiyan. In the meantime, intense fightings are also underway in some parts of Baghlan province, again in northern Afghanistan, after the recapture of Talao Barfak district by Afghan security forces. The Taliban militants have now expanded their attacks and offensives on some other parts of Baghlan, mainly on the of Polikhomri, the capital city of this northern province that connects northern Afghanistan to Kabul.
Okay, I mean, it definitely we'll be back in touch and keeping our eyes very closely on the situation in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for that update out of Kabul. Amin al-Amin. Now to Yemen, where people there have held a rally in the capital, Sana'a, to protest against the Saudi-led blockade on their country and its raising of customs tariffs. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif Awashali, was at the march.
I can see thousands of people are chanting now to the removal of the new tariffs imposed by the former President Hadi government. People here took to the streets to denounce, to criticize, and to blame Saudi Arabia and blame Washington for the blockade, for the peace, for the starvation ongoing against their country. The people here today are really upset with the new tariffs and the new sanctions and everything in terms of their country. The US dollar was counted as 250 riyals in the past, but now had the government made a decision to count it as 500 Yemeni riyals, and this is a big double. It's 100% rate. The Yemenis are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. They are on the brink of famine. This new decision and this new move taken by Hadi government and taken by Washington, as people here believe, will worsen the already dire situation. And the people here in Qatar really chanting against Washington, against Saudi Arabia, against all the sanctions, against the siege, the blockade imposed on the country. They believe that the siege has to be lifted, they have the right to live. They believe also that the continued absence and the continued silence of the international community is another proof of the U.S. participation and the broken rule on their country and on the sanctions and the tightening the siege of their country. They said the former administration of the White House, when Trump was in the White House, things were bitter, but now with the new president, with Biden, everything is getting worse, and this is a proof of the U.S. participation in the war.
A top Iranian military commander says a great part of the United States' decline on the world stage took place in Iraq. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks in a meeting with Falal Fayez, the head of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit. He underlined that Iraq's resistance not only weakened the U.S. military in that country, but also incurred a huge deployment cost. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps noted that the real political power is the one which makes its presence felt in action. He praised the PMU for its defensive capabilities, internal unity, and lofty ideals. He said the Iraqi parliament's ratification on the U.S. troop pullout was aimed at making the country independent and strong, as well as moving forward without the presence of occupiers. The PMU commander, in turn, expressed his gratitude to the IRGC for its assistance in countering the occupiers. The European Union has blamed Iran for last month's deadly attack on an Israeli-managed ship off the coast of Oman. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell claimed in a statement that all available evidence clearly points to Iran. The U.S. and the U.K., as well as Israel, have also accused Tehran of carrying out the attack on the Mercer Street. None of them provided substantial evidence to back their claims. Now, Tel Aviv has also threatened Iran with military action. Tehran has vehemently rejected any involvement in the attack that took place on July the 29th. The country has also warned of a crushing response to any acts of aggression against its territory. A huge wildfire is raging on in the U.S. state of California, leaving a trail of destruction behind as firefighters are trying to contain the flames. Well, the blaze, dubbed the Dixie Fire, is the third largest in the history of California. It has already destroyed 447,000 acres. In the town of Greenville, most of the downtown area has been leveled. At least 8 people are missing. The Dixie Fire started on July the 14th, and officials say it is just 21% contained. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. Well, the coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on India as the country is struggling to contain the disease. India reported well over 39,000 new cases during the last 24 hours, taking its overall tally to nearly 32 million. Deaths also rose by 491 to nearly 428,000. India began the vaccination drive in January of this year. Nearly 500 million of the country's 1.3 billion population have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Now, the spike in recent cases is largely due to the more contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 that was first detected in India itself. Well, Iran slams the U.S.'s nuclear attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on the 76th anniversary of the bombardment, saying the event is a reminder of Washington's great crime against humanity. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the tragedy shows that the United States spares no effort to reach its illegal objectives. He described nuclear weapons as a constant threat to global peace. Khatibzadeh questioned the U.S.'s commitment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and nuclear disarmament. He said Washington has not only failed to take any practical step in this regard, but has also been increasingly modernizing its nuclear arsenals. Around 140,000 people died when the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, before dropping a second bomb on Nagasaki 3 days later.
In the early months of 1945, and despite Germany's official surrender in the Second World War, Tensions showed no signs of abating in the Pacific. Washington, which was still seeking to avenge Tokyo's surprise attacks on its naval base of Pearl Harbor, called for an unconditional surrender of Japan. In the Potsdam Conference in Berlin, China and the so-called Big Three, including Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and US President Harry Truman, said the alternative for Tokyo would be nothing but prompt and utter destruction. But Japan's initial refusal led to what is regarded as one of the darkest moments in human history.
At 8:15 in the morning, a 5-ton bomb fell over the city of Hiroshima in southern Japan.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
Enola Gay, the United States B-29 Superfortress bomber, dropped an atomic bomb called the Little Boy on the center of the city. The nuclear payload, however, was anything but little. In the billionth of a second, it brought the temperature up to 10,000 times hotter than the sun's surface, instantly killing 60 to 80,000 people. The intense heat of the explosion destroyed a massive area of more than 10 kilometers in the blink of an eye. A large number of people, unaware of what happened, walked for considerable distances before they collapsed and died. It caused destruction on an unprecedented scale, but the U.S. praised this human tragedy as a scientific triumph of its own.
We have spent more than $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history, and we have won.
3 days later, Japan woke up to another disaster. At 11:02 in the morning, the United States dropped an even bigger bomb on another southern Japanese city. This time, a plutonium implosion type called Fat Man was dropped on the port city of Nagasaki. One third of the city was destroyed. Nearly all the residents in the hypocenter, tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children were immediately killed by the shockwaves. Only those who were away from home at the time of bombing got a second chance.
6 days after the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, on August the 15th, 1945, grieving Japan agreed to the Allied terms of surrender. Up to this day, the U.S. remains the first and only country to ever use atomic weaponry in wartime. More than 7 decades later, many people are still suffering from cancer, impaired growth, intellectual disabilities, and many other long-term effects of the disaster. But Washington is not even willing to make a single apology for its fatal decision. It acts as one of the prominent advocates against even the peaceful nuclear proliferation of many countries, enforcing different types of punitive measures, like economic sanctions. That is while the US itself possesses substantial nuclear weapons and arsenal, and is one of the only 5 nuclear weapon states recognized in the world.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
in the limelight.
The CIA's notorious practice of kidnapping and displacement gave birth to the post-9/11 torture program. We know nearly nothing about it, says Spencer Eckerman, writer, in an article titled, CIA's Outsourced Torture is Lost to History. Stay tuned for more. Despite their redactions, the pseudonyms, and the thousands of unreleased pages, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report into post-9/11 CIA torture, that is, the executive summary available to the public, is the most robust oversight ever conducted of any part of the so-called War on Terror. The committee typically defends the agencies and activities it nominally oversees. Remarkably, the torture investigation revealed the gruesome realities inside the CIA's black sites. It demonstrated with precision and rigor how the CIA constructed a big lie called enhanced interrogation around its barbarism. But the committee's lead investigator says he could only investigate two of the three components of the torture program. The third is lost to history. The CIA called the program RDI for renditions, detentions, and interrogations. Renditions are outsourced torture. The CIA abducts someone and sends them to be abused either by their home country's security apparatus or, in the extraordinary rendition variant, by a third country's security apparatus. Detentions were the maintenance, logistics, and direct operations of the black sites where the CIA, not an allied intelligence service, imprisoned people. Interrogations were the torture the CIA inflicted. Renditions were the kernel of the program. They were the only aspect of CIA torture in operation on 9/11. The entity within the CIA Counterterrorism Center that conducted it, the renditions group, expanded after 9/11 to become the RDI group, or RDG. One of the people involved in the renditions group from inception, Mike Schur, explained many years ago in an underappreciated video, after 9/11, the CIA was the only game in town. The Bush White House pushed on the CIA to accelerate their rendition program. Sure has been on a journey. Yet we know vastly more about the D and the I than we know about the R. The Senate's investigation solely concerned the CIA's detentions and interrogations. Over the 6 years of the investigation, the CIA fought aggressively to restrict even that constrained mandate. It was not going to allow Senate investigators to expand their remit, according to Daniel J. Jones, the lead investigator. Everything was a heavy lift, Jones remembers. And even if the agency somehow had allowed him to investigate renditions, Jones' experience of digging through deliberately confusing and incomplete records that the CIA provided and sometimes subsequently disappeared leads him to the conclusion that the agency's own renditions records are likely far from extensive. The CIA's detention and interrogation records in 2002 are detailed. As the DI program went on, we saw less and less robust record-keeping, Jones recalls. One could imagine that also applied to rendition. Oh. all three components of the program were tied together, and so occasionally Jones saw glimpses, suggestions, and clues to what rendition was. But not only was rendition beyond the scope of his investigation, he already had to contend with the maddening and painstaking work of figuring out who was and was not in CIA custody, then figuring out how meaningful such distinctions were when it came both to internal classifications and the actual treatment of human beings. Officially speaking, the Senate was able to tally at least 119 people whom the CIA held in the black sites during their 2002 and 2008 existence. There is a back and forth we had with the agency on who was a CIA detainee and who wasn't. The committee to arrive at 119 is extremely conservative. Everyone who was involved in this investigation believes there was more than 119 CIA detainees, Jones explained. If the CIA doesn't know how many people were in its own custody, it's very unlikely there is any record keeping of people who were merely transients, that is, briefly in CIA custody before being whisked to a partner intelligence service, and those who weren't in their custody. Tennis and every other CIA director said the torture program was the CIA's central counterterrorism program at the time because it was a central program and incredibly sensitive. It would be reasonable to think the CIA would maintain a robust classified record, he continued. If, in fact, the DI part was viewed as the central component of the so-called war on terror by the CIA, there is no reason to believe they would hold better records with the rendition program. Two broad facts about CIA torture makes Jones' supposition especially compelling. First, the only reason the Senate Intelligence Committee investigated at all is that two leading figures inside the program, Jose Rodriguez and Gina Haspel, destroyed videotapes of the torture of two men inside the first post-9/11 black site, something that also sparked a criminal investigation. Once the Senate learned about the destruction of those tapes from the New York Times rather than from the CIA, the committee could no longer credibly refuse to open an investigation of its own. Second, in most major speeches and testimony, CIA directors George Tenet, Porter Gross, and Michael Hayden repeatedly emphasized that their so-called war on terror is an international team sport. They did this so often that journalists rarely bothered quoting it. It seemed like boilerplate. It was often self-serving, as when they cited the importance of cooperation with Allied intelligence services as a reason to never disclose what that cooperation did. But they are correct that reliance on various mukhabarats makes their war viable. I cannot overstate how vital these relationships are to our overall effort, Hayden said in one typical September 2007 appearance. The absence of renditions records, even to the Senate torture report, is no longer exactly news. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You cleared out and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward. The worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Right,
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze where you've got it all over you, you're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, okay.
About there? Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole, and they crunched them up with the dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on, digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
The drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to sniff around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for the sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gow sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 2,4-D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 2,4-D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use. 2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost 7 times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and then not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he is constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cos lettuce growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There is no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en, and now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.